Naxos Audiobooks in conversation with Dr. Patrick Tura and Rupert Degas, discussing the author Albert Maltz, hosted by Genevieve Helsby. I'm very, very pleased to welcome Rupert Degas to Naxos Audiobooks. He is a hugely versatile and experienced audiobook reader, an audiophile golden voice, no less. And Dr. Patrick Tura from the University of Akron, Ohio, whose research into American literature has covered the work of Albert Maltz, whom we're here to discuss. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, thanks to the work of Alma Books, we are soon at Naxos Audiobooks to be publishing two of Maltz's titles, A Tale of One January and A Long Day in a Short Life, both read by Rupert. And these are hugely powerful books. I mean, they're wonderful books. And yet the author is not so well known. They won't be titles that are known to many people. So I thought it would be good to start by having a little bit of background on who is Albert Maltz and why has he been hidden from view and why should we be excited to discover his work? Patrick, perhaps you could start us off.
Yes, thank you for that question. It's great to be here. It's exciting to even be talking about Maltz because he was really marginalized for so long in his career, and it's really exciting to see his works being republished, and the audiobooks especially adding so much to that package of bringing Maltz back into the conversation, so to speak. He was born in 1908 in Brooklyn. His parents were Jewish immigrants. They grew up in poverty, but by the time Albert was born, he was the last of three children, had two older brothers. His family was becoming sort of middle class in their father's success. And at the age of three, he remembers, he always claimed to remember this clearly. They were moving into a middle class neighborhood and they were attacked by a gang of boys shouting anti-Semitic epithets and throwing stones at their home. And a rock came through the window and cut Albert's lip at the age of three. And he always claimed that that gave him a real sensitivity to injustice. And that is a thread that runs throughout his career. He really wrote literature of all types, drama, short stories, novels, political tracts, that really were united by a sense of a human search for meaning through moral action. That's a kind of phrase that applies to a lot of Maltz's work. He went to Hollywood in 1941. You would think to just write screenplays, but the writing of screenplays was for Maltz always a means to an end. Screenplay work, which he adjusted to, you know, rapidly in Hollywood, he learned the trade quickly, was well paying. But he never accepted a full-time job with any studio. He accepted individual projects that turned out to be lucrative because his goal was always to free himself from screenwriting work where he didn't have total authority over his own work for the writing of novels, because he wanted his artistic career to be about novel writing. He wanted to be remembered as a novelist. So in terms of screenwriting, though, there is a certain screenplay that he's quite well remembered for. 1945, a little 10-minute short film called The House I Live In, starring Frank Sinatra. Maltz wrote that quickly. It came out with a clear social purpose for the time period. There was a heck of a lot of anti-Semitic violence going on in Boston and New York in the mid-1940s, and that play was all about religious tolerance. And it was given a special Academy Award in 1945 for its contributions to the fight against anti-Semitism in the United States, especially in New York and Boston. So that was maybe, you know, one of the great peaks of Maltz's career. It's just kind of amazing that 5 years after that, he was in prison. In 1947, the House Un-American Activities Committee came calling with subpoenas for screenwriters in Hollywood who had leftist affiliations, and Maltz certainly did have leftist and progressive affiliations in Hollywood. So he was summoned to Washington to testify, and he was one of the Hollywood 10, and their strategy was not to fight the Congressional Committee with the Fifth Amendment, but they decided to challenge it with the First Amendment, the right to free speech and free political association. So Maltz told the Thomas Committee that the American people are going to have to choose between the Bill of Rights and the Thomas Committee. They cannot have both. So contempt of Congress, charges, trial, and then finally he was sentenced to prison in early 1950, and actually A Long Day in a Short Life comes out of his experience in the Washington, D.C. prison, where he spent 18 days and then moved to the Mill Point prison in West Virginia. I will say, too, that, you know, one of the most painful blows for Maltz came in 1960. Frank Sinatra always said, Albert Maltz is the best goddamn writer around. And he tried to hire Albert Maltz in 1960 and break the blacklist, because he believed that Maltz was the perfect person to write a film that Sinatra had purchased called The Execution of Private Slovak. And he took out a full-page ad in Variety magazine saying, I've hired Albert Maltz to write the screenplay for The Execution of Private Slovak. And the backlash was astounding. All of the conservatives, including John Wayne, got a chance to weigh in. He was always eager to attack the left. He was quite conservative and somewhat bigoted. But the backlash from the American Legion and conservatives was amazing, and Sinatra changed his mind. In 2 weeks, he took out another ad saying, I've fired Albert Maltz, and he will not be writing The Execution of Private Slovak. That really hurt Maltz. Died in 1985, still has some works that, with Alma Books, we're eventually going to put out, two novels that have yet to see the light of day.
Well, wow. Thank you very much.
That's quite a history.
Amazing, absolutely amazing. And I think that the, I mean, even from the two books that we're doing, they're so different. Mm. And yet I feel that you get this sense of shared humanity, and everything that he believes is in these characters that are so strong, and that the fact that he was a playwright and did screenplays, there's something very vivid about these books and the characters. And for me, Rupert being somebody who absolutely immerses his readers. I mean, Rupert, you read, you perform books, right? You really immerse people. And I wonder how these books moved you, and what you felt when you were reading.
I mean, it's just interesting, really interesting listening to Patrick talking then. I am a film nut. I've been almost a sort of a movie aficionado. Is that the word? I've been obsessed with cinema and Hollywood since I was a child. And also World War II history and American history have always been sort of interests of mine. So I've kind of loved prison movies and war movies and Holocaust movies. So when I narrate an audiobook, it's a movie in my head, because I'm a movie buff. I'm not a book buff. I do read a lot of books, but I don't read fiction for my own amusement. I read nonfiction. I read history. I read politics. I read books about philosophy, finance, whatever. I only read nonfiction. So because I narrate about 20 or 30 audiobooks a year, they're all mainly fiction. I do the odd nonfiction audiobook, but they're mainly fiction. So I'm getting my fiction hit from audiobooks. I don't read fiction apart from that. I get my fiction from movies. So being a movie buff, it's just totally sort of like breathing for me to infuse a book with as a screenplay. I see it as a screenplay. I see it as a Netflix series, or I see it as an epic movie. You know, I mean, I was one of those weird 8-year-olds that could list, I was, you know, 9 years old, I could list all of David Lean's films and who the cinematographers were, and movie soundtracks. I've been into movie music all my life. I've collected, you know, John Williams, Jerry Goldsmith, you know, Danny Elfman, you know, you name it, been obsessed with film music. So again, when I narrate an audiobook, I'm hearing a score in my head. And I look at a lot of people maybe don't want that when they're reading a book. They just want to read a story as if they're reading it to someone. Hopefully what I do is infuse some of my love of the film industry. And because of Albert Maltz being a screenwriter, yes, his books, they come off the page like a film. And I see the characters in my head and I can picture them the way he describes them. I can hear their voices. And, you know, I'll give you a little hack, but I do kind of cast it in my head as a movie and go, who would I cast? And when I, in especially in a long day in a short life, I'm going, okay, well, this is a kind of Morgan Freeman character. Okay, this is kind of Denzel. This is Eddie Murphy doing a great role. And I'm kind of infusing a bit of that. I'm not doing an impression, but I'm trying to bring in the essence so that at least I, in my head, to indulge myself, go, I've cast Morgan Freeman. Yeah. I've cast Bryan Cranston. I've cast whoever, you know. I can't, Michael Shannon, whoever, I can't think of. But so that's kind of where I am. And I love it. I get an absolute thrill out of doing it because it just means I want to know what happens next.
Yeah. You know, in a Tale of One January, you've got six characters and all six are from different countries, different nationalities.
Right? Yeah.
So this was, you know, something pretty virtuosic for you to do. Is that actually a helpful distinction that they're all so different, or is that seriously challenging?
No, I mean the worst thing for me is like I'm narrating a book at the moment, and all the characters are English apart from two Scots. I have to make all of them sound different, and I'm going, okay, can one be from the north of England? Can one be from East Anglia? Because in my head, if they all sound the same to the listener, I mean, I can change my voice, obviously, but to make it really distinctive, having a Pole and a French and a Russian and an Austrian and a German, it's a gift. But at the same time, it's a challenge because you go, okay, now I have to differentiate the German from the Austrian. So you go, all right. So I'm a big Formula One nut. So I go, okay, Austrian. So that's going to be Niki Lauda, Toto Wolff, Gerhard Berger, Arnold Schwarzenegger. So you have that kind of Austrian voice, which is quite different from a German voice. When you actually think about it, it's when you listen to Austrian and German next to each other, you can tell the difference. So it's like, I think Norbert was German. I've got to give it a damn hot go, a shake of the sauce bottle, as we say in Australia.
So it's an impressive thing, I think, that you also find Maltz's novel cinematic.
Yes.
You would guess that he was a damn good screenplay writer, correct? Yeah,
absolutely.
I do hold out some hope that the film industry will get a little bit interested in these novels.
I do too. And I think A Tale of One January, you know, there's been so many films set in the Second World War, set in concentration camps, but no film has actually started a week before the end of the war on a walk from the camp where they run. So you never actually see Auschwitz at all.
Right.
It's all set in, and also how these characters ended up in Auschwitz when they were not Jews. That poses a question as well. It's just that the futility of war is hideous. And then it doesn't become a story about Jews escaping from Auschwitz. It becomes a story about six people who you don't know.
That's what Maltz wanted.
It's irrelevant.
That whole decision of the six, you know, one of the titles that he considered for the novel was The Six. He saw these six characters as very special people. And I think that also is a new kind of Holocaust approach. Six special people thrown together by fate and chance who, you know, what it becomes for me is a story of comradeship and love among these people kind of being reborn as human beings. I got, you know, from reading it and from listening to it, Rupert, I was so moved. I can't, you know, I really am choked up every time I listen to that ending. You know, the love of sorts between Andre and Claire is quite powerful. And that makes it, you know, I think a kind of unique kind of Holocaust narrative as well.
I thought just, I remember the scene at the beginning when they're hiding under the straw in the barn. And the Germans are coming in with the bayonets poking. And it took me to the opening sequence of Inglourious Basterds by Tarantino, where he's hiding the Jews under the floorboards and Christoph Waltz comes in and drinks milk. And it's the chilling. Yeah. It's so chilling. And I immediately was reading it and I felt this sense of chilling fear. And of course, both books, Albert Maltz brings in musical stings, which is sort of, you know, goes back to my thing of having film scores in my head.
Well, I think what's wonderful is that you get that fear you're talking about, but you also get this incredible warmth in the people he draws, the characters he draws. Yeah. And those pieces of music that he mentions, I mean, he obviously had a lot of knowledge and love of music. And in our production, we've celebrated that by putting music into it, which is really nice, makes it a whole production. But I think... well, it'd be very nice to hear a little extract. This part of the book is fairly early on and all our characters are hiding together. And Claire has just discovered that Andre, who is Russian, is a musician. He's a cellist. And there's the wonderful idea of him playing the cello without having a cello. So he just plays a board and it's as if they can hear this music, and that I think that's extraordinary.
Please, Lenny said with tears in her voice, let's make a pact. No more talk of the war, no more talk of the camp. My God, we're free. Let's only think of good things now, of life, of home. Her words turned into sobs. Claire embraced her, whispering, hush, Linny dear, I'll make that pact with you. I'm sorry.
Andrei spoke up suddenly and in a bullying tone.
What is wrong me? Now I have cello, why I don't play? I play you now by Mendelssohn something. You will see. Into here it will bring sun and home and dancing. You listen now.
With the board between his knees, he began to play.
I also want to point out, or maybe just mention, that how also faithful to the historical record of Dunja Wasserstrom's interviews with Maltz, the book actually is. You know, it really follows closely the details of their escape. The characters and nationalities, for the most part, are very close to that Holocaust testimonial, which was also a Holocaust testimony in court. Remember, Dunja Wasserstrom was called to Frankfurt in 1964 to testify. And in the Frankfurt trials of Nazi war criminals, and they didn't even know if she was going to be able to do this because she was very reticent in the lead up to the hearings. But suddenly she shocked everyone with that story of the boy and the apple. And I won't give away how it's different in the novel, but this was something totally unexpected that Maltz preserved and curated in this novel, which is fiction, but, you know, so valuable too, as a record of the Holocaust. I'm just amazed that it was published in the United States for the first time only last year in 2023. It just sat for way too long.
Patrick, I'm wondering if, I don't live in America, but I had no idea that black prisoners were on a different tier from white prisoners. I did not know that prisons were racially segregated.
Oh, yes.
I mean, maybe completely. That was surprising to me.
Recently. Yeah. Right. And, you know, the African-American writer who helped Maltz with the manuscript, Lloyd Brown, he had experience in the segregated section of the Pittsburgh jail. Pretty much automatically segregated. And that makes for another intriguing part of the plot, too. How do McPeak and Huey Wilson manage to interact and talk with each other and discuss their strategy? They need help. They need advice. Huey Wilson is a young activist. He's a political force of it in his own right, but he needs help from his cellmates. And I think that is, in part, that's a little bit of what I think Lloyd Brown added to the manuscript with his collaboration, you can call it, with Maltz. Huey Wilson is not alone. He's not a single, separate self. And I think, you know, that moment near the end of the novel when he recommits politically and becomes more of an optimist than a pessimist, even though he's in solitary confinement, is when he remembers that he's got a lawyer behind him, he's got a brother behind him, he's got a father behind him, and he decides that the way he's going to make his life meaningful is to assume a place in his family history that has been fighting the battle, you know, against racism in the United States for decades and decades, going back to, you know, antebellum slavery. And I think that's a feature of the book that really also makes it important in terms of its accurate and moving kind of recapitulation of the history of the black struggle in the United States.
With Huey, when he was demonstrating at his college, and yet, you know, it's almost like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but Huey was almost the trailblazer for Rosa Parks. You know,
yeah.
It's that, and it's sort of, oh wow, this is in the 40s, and you know, Huey's just a young black boy who's not doing anything racially motivated. He's just out there protesting because of it, because of college, because of a student thing, and then these, you know, three sort of bigots come and beat him up, right? And then also McPeak's character, who his redemption, or not even his redemption, but he's like a guy going, I don't judge people by the color of their skin, MLK, right? I judge people by the content of their character. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're a dick, you're a dick. I don't care if you're black or white, just don't be a dick, right? Mm-hmm. And McPeak has this inner struggle of being a kind of a, he calls himself a redneck anyway, or he calls himself, right? Yeah. He's like, my whole family's supposed to not, but here's this kid who's, we're equal in this prison.
I see Huey Wilson as you do. It's amazing that he is 18 years old in 1946 and demonstrating for desegregation, which was really, we think of that as the issue of the 1950s in this country. Brown versus Board of Education decision, which legislates integration and causes, you know, demonstration after demonstration and anti-demonstrations back and forth, which really, you know, like, roils the country and divides the country all throughout the second half of the 1950s. But here is an 18-year-old in 1946 who wants his school to be integrated, who needs his school to be integrated. So he is an amazing and forward-looking character. And that's also something that would have made the book much more relevant in 57 when it was, you know, if you want to call it published, it was really not distributed. Of course, it was suppressed. McPeak, you know, a Georgia upbringing, a Georgia racist upbringing, but he sheds that upbringing when he works in a factory in Detroit and works alongside African Americans and learns from that one character that is mentioned only by his nickname, Balance Wheel, who teaches him, about the metaphor of the keys. You know, the black key and the white key can open the door to progress. And he's amazing, too, because his greatest moments are not moments in which he stops to think necessarily. We get the real McPeak when he sees Huey Wilson getting beat up, and almost unthinkingly, he jumps into the fray to save a fellow human being. And he knows that Huey Wilson is black and why he's being, you know, quasi-lynched.
There's so many. I loved it. I just thought it was amazing. The guy, I can't remember the character's name, but who was sleeping with the married woman, and he...
Oh, yeah,
Varney. And he accidentally, you know, he defends himself and breaks the guy's nose and kills him, and, you know, manslaughter. And when the judge gave his deliberation, and again, it's that the same thing of loving thrillers and cop shows growing up as well, going,
yes.
Oh, the judge is just, he's tired, it's the end of the day, he's bored, he's,
yeah, yes.
You know, and you're going, this is the guy's whole life that you have in your hands.
Yeah.
And you make a decision because you're thinking about your dinner or whatever it is.
Varney's pacing had ceased at this point. He had sat down in a corner of the room alone and very still, an unlit cigarette between his lips. Feverishly, he had begun to tell himself that he knew the judge was decent. He could tell by his face that he was a man of heart and understanding. He told himself this, but in the next moment grew cold with fear again, as he thought that no judge ever knew what prison time meant. Where was the judge who had spent even a week in one of the prisons to which he sent other men for 10 or 20 years? Thinking along in this way, so frightened and lonely that his spirit could not bear it, Varney sought refuge in magic. His mind fled back to a crowded courtroom, where the issue of his guilt or innocence still was undecided. "Ladies and gentlemen," Combs was saying to the jury, "when you hear the facts in this case, I think you will agree with me that this unfortunate slaying was an act of self-defense, and that Floyd Varney deserves to go free." In this way, by dreaming nonsense, Varney achieved a false calm for these last terrible moments before court opened. But then suddenly the door of the bullpen was unlocked, and a bailiff thrust his head inside. He called out loudly so that even Varney heard him, "Any of you guys want to use the toilet before you go to court, line up." Varney rose, feeling as though something had just died within him. His heart began to pound, and a cold sweat bubbled out on his forehead. He held out his wrists for the handcuffs.
Just so brilliantly written. It's the words, just for an actor, this man writes dialogue. Albert Maltz writes dialogue brilliantly. I mean, he's a brilliant dialogue writer, and it's a joy to perform his words, because I wasn't tripping up. It was just flowing out, because he just writes with that beautiful rhythm, the way people speak. And it was an absolute joy. It was a highlight of 2023, was narrating that book, I've got to say.
Well, I think we've got a perfect...
I love the way you did it in the book. Go ahead. Sorry.
I think we've got a perfect marriage with Maltz and you, Rupert.
I can't believe I'd never...
Such a highly dramatic scene.
Yeah.
Incredibly dramatic, incredibly powerful, saddening and maddening at the same time, because that judge is so incapable of understanding. So locked up in his own selfish world that he's incapable of compassion at all, or any kind of empathy.
And Varney was hoping that the wife, the widow of the man, would come to his aid, just there in the courtroom.
Great scene. Great chapter.
Just just brilliant, brilliant stuff. This has to be made something.
Can you imagine, you know, I think you did such a wonderful job with it, but in a film, it would work.
Yeah. I mean, I could play all the parts.
You could.
Deep fake, you know, just...
I know you could.
You already have, Rupert. You already
I know.
Have.
I'm getting greedy.
That's right.
Well, thank you guys for giving me the opportunity to do these. I hope people listen to them and read them. And I hope some Hollywood producer sees the value in adapting them. And I'm available.
You're here.
And I want to thank you for the experience of listening to them. And thank you, Genevieve, too, for arranging this. But the experience of listening to those books by you has been amazing. And also, it makes me more committed to making sure that Maltz gets his due.
Excellent.
Or doing what I can, at least.
Thank you, Patrick.